2 weeks ago, Pope Pius VI spent a day in Israel. His visit was part of a tour of the places which are holy to Christendom. But the visit excited much political speculation. The Vatican has never recognized the State of Israel. Indeed, before 1948, Vatican diplomats were busy in the chanceries of the world, asking that a Jewish state not be authorized, and suggesting an international mandate for the Holy Land, or failing that at the minimum, the internationalization of the sacred city of Jerusalem. The Church expected to have a seat on either of these commissions. It was clear that Israel hoped that the Pope's visit would lay the groundwork for a more normal and more cordial relationship. Israel is rightfully proud of its fine record of religious liberty. The Israeli government has encouraged Christian pilgrimage in the Christian shrines. And it was hoped that the proper and warm welcome of the Pope and his own firsthand witness of Israel's sturdy growth might encourage him to suggest a new basis for diplomatic relationship. But the Pope studiously avoided any political commitment. Indeed, upon his return to the Vatican, the bread and butter letter which he sent to President Shazar of Israel, thanking him for his hospitality, was addressed not to the capital in Jerusalem, but to Tel Aviv. Perhaps a secretarial oversight, more likely a deliberate way of underscoring that the Church does not yet recognize Israel's claim to its own capital, and certainly a rather petty and demeaning act by a great church. What was the purpose of the Pope's visit? Whenever he spoke of it in public, Paul labeled it a personal pilgrimage of prayer. But it was certainly something far more than a private devotion. As you know, the Eastern Orthodox Catholic Church and the Roman Church have been negotiating for many years to heal a schism which is as old as the 11th century. There are some 70 million Eastern Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, and Russian Orthodox Catholics. And both groups have been eager to seal the breach, for they face, on the one hand, a resurgent Islam, which has been making remarkable progress in the missionary field, and on the other hand, they face the political advances of anti-religious communism, which has taken over large Catholic centers in Central and Eastern Europe. The time was propitious for a binding together, a drawing together for strength. And the time had obviously come when the two titular heads of these great church bodies had to meet, and in their embrace and their smile and their conversation to act as the symbol and the catalyst for further negotiations. But where should they meet? If the patriarch were to go to Rome, he would be roundly criticized in Constantinople. If the Pope were to go to Constantinople, he would have been roundly criticized in Rome. So Paul and Athenagoras went to neutral ground, to Muslim Jordan, where they could both meet with dignity and where they could accomplish their mission. And apparently it was well accomplished, because just 2 days ago, the Church released the text of a letter which Paul had sent to all of his bishops, in which he indicated that though there was yet time needed to complete negotiations, he felt confident that Christian or Catholic unity would be established. Now, there were some Jewish observers who looked on Paul's visit to Israel as a gesture of friendship, both to Israel and to Jews, and as another evidence of what they liked to think of as a new church attitude in relation to the Jews. Let it be said first off that the church made no such claim. I am afraid that much of this is the product of wishful thinking. Indeed, the way in which the pilgrimage was organized makes one feel that the church would have wished that the holy places of the Bible might have been located in any other piece of geography than in Israel itself. They simply could not avoid Israel. It was not that they wanted to go there. Before the Pope left from Rome, private remonstrance has been made in all the Arab capitals that his visit to Israel implied no recognition of the state, no approval of Zionism, by which the church understands the interest of Jews in the state, and no commitment towards Judaism or towards Israel on the church's part. Is there, in fact, a new outlook by the church on its relations to Jews? There is some indication that there is a tentative, uncertain concern on the part of the church. But certainly no new positions have been crystallized or taken or pronounced. On what do Jews who argue that there is a new evaluation base their argument? On what I believe to be a misunderstanding of the purpose and the emphasis of the Vatican Council. The Vatican Council is first and foremost a housekeeping council designed to bring the cumbersome organization of the church up to date for the frenetic demands of the 20th century. And its second and other major thrust is Christian unity. The council is designed to draw together again all those who belong to what the Catholics call the mystical body of Christ, all those who affirm the reality of Christ as the Son of God. This very Sunday, in churches and parishes throughout the world, an octave of Christian unity is being celebrated, which emphasizes desire by Protestant and Catholic groups alike to draw together for greater cooperation, for the greater glory of their faith. The church has signalized its willingness to leave off its old position of exclusiveness, by which it polemicized and argued against the deviationist, the heterodox, the Protestant, and to adopt a new program which it calls ecumenicity, by which it means a drawing together, a binding of old wounds for the greater glory of their God. The Eastern Orthodox Church and the World Council of Churches of Christ maintained at the Vatican Council official observers. The words have been spoken. The beginnings of an ecumenical movement are underway. Though I, for one, have long believed that the Protestant and the Catholic groups do not understand the same sense when they speak of ecumenicity. To the Protestant, I believe, the ecumenical movement means simply a drawing together for cooperative religious and moral endeavor. But the Catholic has not renounced the position of authority, of leadership. To the Catholic, I believe, the ecumenical movement means a drawing together under the aegis of the Holy See. The road is long. There is a great desire on the part of both Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, and Catholic to accomplish it. And already in our local communities, we can see some of the ramifications of this ecumenical spirit. Because the high wall of distance and of silence which has separated for too many years now the Roman cleric from the minister and rabbi has begun to break down. They are more willing than ever to share in community enterprise, to undertake even religious dialogue and communication. And all this, of course, is to the good. But Judaism is not a Protestant sect. The Secretariat for Christian Unity is not concerned primarily with Jews or with any other religion save the Christian faith. And I believe it to be a fundamental misunderstanding of the Vatican Council's purpose if one believes that it is concerned or was designed to be concerned with Catholic-Jewish relations. There are those within the Church who would like to see our relationships placed on a new basis. The Pope's predecessor, that grand old man of the great heart, John the 23rd, was such a man. You'll recall that John, in March of 1959, ordered excised from the Mass of Good Friday that invidious and demeaning formula, Oremus a pro per fides Judaeus, and we further pray for the insolent Jew. John was a man of great goodwill and of fine spirit, one of the few high churchmen who during the Second World War was energetic in behalf of Jews. Augustine Cardinal Bea, the head of the Secretariat on Christian Unity, is another such man. And he went one step further than his mentor, the Pope, and he introduced, over great opposition to the Vatican Council, a schema or theological chapter concerned with Catholic-Jewish relationships. This had not been in the original program of the conference. And this schema said, in effect, three things. First, that the Catholic Church recognizes that its beginnings are the contribution of those whom God elected as his chosen people, the Jews, the Bible. That the Catholic Church further recognizes that Jesus was in the flesh, a Jew, that God again chose a Jew to be the messenger of his gospel, and that this fundamental historical relationship must never be forgotten. Secondly, that all men bear some burden for the death of Jesus. He died because of man's sinfulness. That though there were Jews who were actively involved in the crucifixion, which is not necessarily historically so, but so claimed in this schema, that though there were Jews involved in the actual crucifixion, not all Jews of that day can be held guilty of it, nor can Jews of subsequent generations or of today be held guilty. And finally, he advised preachers and catechists that when they teach the story of the crucifixion, they are to follow this understanding of historical truth, the one he has outlined, that they are to remember that any teaching of this crucifixion is not to add to the unfortunate sum of world bias and hatred, and indeed that it is their bounden duty to promote mutual understanding and esteem. Now, this schema is written in the language of goodwill, and it was gladly received by Catholic and Jewish circles alike. It was good to hear that the taunt Christ killer would no longer receive even marginal theological sanction. It was good to know that the Church would urge its ministers to promote mutual understanding and esteem. When one considers this theological document of a Vatican Council against the document of another Vatican Council, the Fourth Lateran of 1215, the change is radical, nay, dramatic. At the Fourth Lateran, under the aegis of Innocent III, much had been said about the Jews. Our knavery was dilated upon. Jews were ordered to wear on their outer garments a yellow badge of shame. Shame because we were too obstinate and obdurate to accept the truth of Christ, either when he spoke his gospel or in subsequent generations. And much was said in prohibition. No Jewish physician may attend a Christian patient. No Jewish housewife may employ a Christian maid. No Christian prince may employ a Jewish official. A policy of religious apartheid was established. The Jew was immured, walled in, condemned to a life of wandering and shame, the Jew's degradation to prove the exaltation of Christianity. We have come a long way, and it is good that we have come that way. But I would remind you that the schema of Augustine Cardinal Bea was not passed at the last session of the Vatican Council. It was tabled on a minor matter of procedure. Supposedly, it is to be reopened at the fall term of 1964. Let us hope that it will be. Let us hope that it will pass in its integrity. For if this document should be watered down or not passed, the mist of misunderstanding which has existed between Catholic and Jew through the centuries, and which has slowly been dissipating under the warming sun of tolerance, this mist will grow the danker and the darker and the more bitter. There is, however, as indicated by this tabling, I am afraid, some opposition within the church, even in this day and age, to what was said in the schema. And I would remind you further that even this liberal statement, for all of its advance, for all of its nobility, continues to see the Jew not as we are, but through theological spectacles as the church assumes us to be. We are not granted the privilege of our independent destiny. We are the elect, God's chosen people, who had the truth and rejected the second truth, and who in the drama of salvation must be brought back to the truth. The era of missionaries and of missions is not behind us. Our Cleveland Archbishop can still this very week order in every church of his diocese that the people pray for the conversion of the Jew. Now, to remind you that this has quite practical connotations. It means, in the first place, that the church still arrogates to itself the right to use political and social institutions to bring men to the truth, to encourage religion in the schools, because the greater truth to which we are blind is a necessary medicine for our souls, the way, the only way to our salvation. And I would suggest also that it is this position which explains the church's ambivalent attitude towards Israel. Because Israel is above all else a statement of our integrity, of our individual destiny, that we are not dependent upon the Christian world, but are carving out our own place in history. And we have no such individual destiny within this Christian theology. The ambivalence of the Christian world, the meaning of the term religious freedom or religious understanding, was never better illustrated than the Pope's final statement of farewell, an impromptu statement to President Shazar of Israel at the Mandelbaum Gate in Jerusalem 2 weeks ago. He began by speaking words which were welcome. He spoke of the goodwill which was in his heart, in the heart of the church, for all men and for all peoples. And he said that the church loves everybody in equal measure. But then, surprisingly, he deviated from this theme. And he went on to attack those whom he said had cast suspicion on the memory of his predecessor but one in office, Pope Pius XII. Of what was Pope Pius suspect? Of not having loved everybody in equal measure, of guiding a church which had not known the true meaning of love. Specifically, Pius was suspect of having known of the monstrosity of the Nazi death camps, because of some narrow concerns with Christian and Catholic institutions, of having bridled his mouth and maintained his silence. No cry of moral outrage came from the church in those bitter years. And no one in Israel had mentioned this suspicion to the Pope during his visit. The Pope had reference rather to a play authored by a young West German Catholic by the name of Rolf Hochhut. The play is entitled The Representative. It caused quite a furor when it was produced first in Basel last year, for it is a bitter, denunciatory play. Its action is simply this. A young Jesuit priest is in Berlin during the war, and he learns quite inadvertently of the existence of the death camps. Every fiber of his spiritual being and decency is shocked. He is sure that the church will take action. He hastens to Rome. He gains audience with the Pope. He pours out his bitterness, his urgency to the Pope. And the Pope is strangely unruffled and unmoved. And he turns the conversation again and again back on minor institutional Jesuit matters. And this young priest, in anger, rips off his collar in a very dramatic way, joins a group of Italian Jews who are being led off into Auschwitz. Pope Paul's defense of Pius's actions made there in Jerusalem 2 weeks ago was simply this. That Pius was a sensitive, decent, deeply spiritual and charitable man, and that he knew that many had come to Pius after the war to thank him for having saved their lives. Now, where lies the truth? The truth is with Pius. The truth is rather with Paul. Many did come to thank the Pope and the Vatican for having saved their lives. But the truth is also with a young playwright. Pope Pius did know of the Nazi monstrosities. He did know of the genocide, of the extermination of the millions. And if he spoke out, no one recognized his words. There was no indignation, no passion, no marshaling of the power of the church. And if he made private remonstrance, it is not recorded in history. By the standard of a narrow charity, the Pope Pius stands vindicated. By the standard of a broad prophetic morality which recognizes no responsibility greater than that of the responsibility of man to man, of decency to decency, he fails to meet the mark. And we have here, I believe, in very bold black and white form, some understanding of the confusion within the church today as to its relationships with other groups, specifically with our own. They will enlarge the area of charity. There will be more civic cooperation. There will be more dialogue. There will be a greater speaking of the words of goodwill. But the church has not yet made up its mind that it lives in a pluralistic society, that it shares a responsibility to all men which is greater than its responsibility to the church itself. In brief, at the synagogues, or the churches, or the mosque's responsibility to justice and to freedom, to mankind, outweighs any responsibility to the religious institution itself. In brief, that you and I as Jews have a right to carve out our own individual destiny, and that our purpose in life is not ultimately to be reunited to some larger body, but to work with them in consort and partnership for the common good. Why do I speak these words? I speak them because they underscore that this is not the hour to embarrass the church with effusive kindness. This is the hour in which we should retain our dignity, know things as they are and see them not as we wish them to be, but as they are in reality. And the truth is also underscored here that ultimately our future as Jews depends upon the spiritual integrity and depth of our Jewish communities, upon the strength of Israel, upon the depth and strength of our own spiritual commitments. We cannot yet depend upon the goodwill of any other group, religious or secular. Their interests are their own, not ours. Their interests are institutional, not as yet, as we would wish them, magnificently humanitarian. Let us be proud, let us be understanding, let us be knowledgeable, let us be committed. That is the way of survival, that is the way of the future. But also, let us not be narrow, nor parochial. If we accuse Christians of often confusing us with those who may have been guilty of a crime 2,000 years ago, let us not be guilty of the same historical fallacy. The priest in the parish around the corner is not the same man who 3 or 4 centuries ago on Easter Sunday exhorted his congregation about the libelous Jew, the perfidious Jew, the blind Jew, the knave Jew, who after he had whipped them up into a frenzy, led them out to a happy afternoon of bloodletting in the ghetto. He is a different man. His code of life is fundamentally and radically changed. He is seeking to join with us in some kind of human partnership. Because under the aspect of history, let us remember that the church is only now, in the year 1964, taking its first tentative steps into a world which is pluralistic and complicated, in which the church can no longer assume that it has a majority of power or of believers, a world in which it must learn to live and to let live, in which it can no longer direct easily or fully the destinies of men. I have spoken soberly and, I hope, judiciously of the relationships between Catholic and Jew. On a private level, they are much warmer always than they seem to be when we discuss this from the level of the hierarchy and from the level of authority. We do well to recognize that there are those many at all levels of the church who are most eager that the church outgrow its own exclusiveness. But not all the church. Perhaps not yet most of the church. What shall we say? Gam zu letova. The change, however tentative it be, however small the steps which are being taken, all these changes are for the good. And let us remember not to be downcast. Nothing is certain, fixed, and immutable in history, not even a dogma of the church. The Church of Innocent III, the Fourth Lateran, is far different in spirit than the Church of Pius VI of the present Vatican Council. And there will be other meetings and other definitions. And each, I believe, will lead us closer and closer to a full understanding and tolerant partnership. And until then, let us welcome every overture. Let us undertake every friendly conversation. Let us cooperate in every communal enterprise. But let us do so with dignity and with a proud assurance. We have a faith which is good, venerable, meaningful to us, as the Catholic has a faith which is good and venerable and meaningful to him. And that what our world needs in this trying hour is not bitterness or discord, but the tying of the knots of friendship, the building of bridges, the establishment of understanding. If the church can speak of teaching of Judaism with mutual understanding and esteem, so ought we, as best we can, to teach our children to look on the church with understanding and esteem. Let us clear the mist. Let us let in the sunlight. And let us hope that the church will join with us in this pilgrimage to understanding. Amen.